You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Mark Lynch and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is archaeologist Stephen Mithen. He's a professor of early prehistory at the University of Reading. And we're talking about his book, The Language Puzzle, piecing together the 6 million year story of how words evolved. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike. Thanks.
Now, for people who didn't read the book yet and are listening to this, this is a book about the evolution of speech and words before writing. And people would think, how the hell could you figure out the evolution of something that would leave no physical traces?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty strange topic, really, for an archaeologist, because, you know, we dig up hard evidence, bits of rock and bits of stone and fireplaces and paintings and so forth. But I've got interested in language because I think we can't really explain any of those objects that were made in the past or how societies changed in the past or how they change today without addressing the topic of language, because even today we see that the driving of changes in society and economies and culture. So we have to try to find some proxy evidence for language in the past. We can't hear the past. The past is silent. Writing only started 5,000 years ago. But, you know, we can look at the fossil record of early humans and try to reconstruct the vocal tract, see whether the vocal tract, that's the way that they're breathing and the form of the mouth and the oral tract, the ear bones, whether they are same as ours or very different. And if they're same, that might suggest they're using language. We can also look at the size of the brain, and these days we can get some idea about the structure of the brain as well from fossil casts, and we can see whether we think that's a sort of brain that might have had language. But then we can also look at actual material culture, the tools, whether they're stone tools or later periods of wooden tools or fireplaces or paintings on walls, and ask the questions, would language have been necessary to have made those?
Right.
And when they're absent, is that because language wasn't there? So we have to draw lots of different strands of evidence together, not only from archaeology, but from other disciplines, to try and build up this picture. It is difficult, and that's why I call my book a bit of a puzzle, really, that I'm trying to solve.
I love that, because you use that analogy or that metaphor of a puzzle. You even talk about putting around the edge pieces first and then filling in the pieces that are in the beginning. And you talk about the origin of language as one of the hardest problems in science.
Yeah, it's been described by that. That wasn't my phrase. It was described by that by some scientists recently. I mean, I don't know if it is the case or not. You know,
it seems a pretty hard problem to me. Minus a time difficult machine, I don't think we're going to be able. It's not an easy problem to definitively solve.
Yeah, you see, the really difficulty is, you know, chimpanzees living today are our closest living relative.
Mm.
We shared an ancestor with them between 6 and 8 million years ago. And we can assume that ancestor was a bit like a chimpanzee, really. Now, when we listen to chimpanzees' communication, you know, the grunting and the barking, these aren't random noises. They're not just emotional outbursts, but they're certainly not words, and they don't have grammar. And what we have to try to understand is, how did a communication system made of barks and grunts and so forth develop this remarkably complex phenomenon that we use of language, that we use effortlessly?
Mm.
You know, Mark, you probably know 70,000 different types of words, I guess, and
right,
you string them in different orders without any effort at all, and I can understand what you're talking about. You may well speak several different languages as well. It's a remarkable thing that we do with language. So it is we have that big black gap in the middle between a chimpanzee-like communication and a modern human-like communication. And in that gap, there's Homo habilis and Homo erectus and the Neanderthals. And we can't listen to them, but we're obliged to try to work out how they communicated, because unless we do that, we won't understand the most precious gift we have as human beings, which is our ability to use language.
As you're right, I think one of the phrases you used is, we have a real passion. Humans have an amazing joy of words. I mean, we love talking. We love language. Now, you push the formation of language back to about 10,000 years ago?
No, a lot longer. No, much longer than that. I mean, I'd push the... Of course, it depends what you mean by the origin of the language, because I think language evolved in lots of little gradual stages.
Okay. And I think, but a full-blown modern type of language, would it go back to 10,000 years ago?
Like you and me speak. Now, I'd put that about 100,000 years ago.
Okay.
I'd put that about 100,000 years ago when the late Homo sapiens, and you know, that coincides at a time, or it's just before, a big dispersal out of Africa. It's a time when we get the first symbolism, the first geometric symbolic images being made on stone. It's a bit later than that we get the cave paintings. This is all happening in the Ice Age. And then when the Ice Age comes to an end, at about 10,000 years ago, that's when agriculture is invented, and agriculture leads to everything else in the modern world so very quickly. And I think that's all a consequence of being this really creative, inventive mind that's driven forward by language.
People who start to read the book may be surprised that one of the earliest chapters is a complete overview of hominid evolution. It's an amazing chapter. It's like you've taken a whole full course in hominid evolution. But I wanted to ask you, what can we tell from the fossil evidence of hominids about the capacity for language?
Well, it's kind of you describe it like that. I mean, I have been teaching human evolution for the last 40 years or so, but, you know, this is still a very rapidly changing field.
Oh, yeah.
Still new discoveries being made, and the last 10 years has been revolutionized by the ability to look at the genetics of Neanderthals and humans. But what can we tell from the fossil record about speech? Well, we can see that the vocal tract of the Neanderthals is pretty identical to our own today.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they had language, but it's difficult to understand why that would have been evolved in such a similar manner to us if they're not using words and they're not using sounds. I think their language was quite different to ours, but nevertheless, they had some sort of vocal communication. And then you can actually take that a bit further back, actually all the way to about 500,000 years ago, which I think is another sort of threshold when the physical apparatus for speech was in place. The vocal tract, we can look at the tiny ear bones and find that they're all identical to ours today as well, or near identical. So they're able to pick up all the different frequencies of sounds, which are so essential in speech. This doesn't mean they're speaking the same as us, because as well as the physical apparatus, you need the mental apparatus. So you need what's happening in the brain to be able to generate the sounds and process the sounds that you're hearing.
Now, you also mentioned in the book, you just mentioned Neanderthals. What about the Denisovians? Did they have language too? Is the feeling that they were comparable to the Neanderthals?
Yeah, very likely. I mean, I don't write much about the Denisovians because it's still such a mystery. But
There's not as much fossil evidence at all.
Yeah, so what the around 600,000 years ago, there was a species that split into two lineages, one leading to Homo sapiens, that's you and me, and one leading to Neanderthals. And then that Neanderthal lineage split again, one off to the Denisovans. And they were living mainly in Eastern Asia, and they seemed to have had adaptations to quite high latitudes. And they were probably very similar to Neanderthals, and very similar to Homo sapiens as well, but had a slightly different physiological adaptation to the sorts of environments they were living in. I suspect they had language as well, but we only have a few bones from them. We know their genes reasonably well now. We know that they also interbred with modern humans and interbred with Neanderthals as well. But they remain one of the mystery species, and there's probably more mysterious species that we're yet to discover, I think, because as more and more is found out by the genetics of the past, we realize there's a much greater variation there than we previously thought.
One of the fascinating discussions you have in the book, and it's complicated, and I don't expect you to talk about all the fineries about it, but the periods of glaciation, how would the various periods of glaciation affect not only the evolution of language, but what about the dispersal of different languages?
Yeah, well, you know, we talk about the last ice age, but in fact, there was lots of last ice ages.
Right, right.
Because from about 2 million years ago, the global climate was going constantly into an ice age, a glaciation, as the glaciers extended in northern latitudes and the landscape became drier and harsher. And then after cycles about 40,000 years, it began to get warmer. And then trees spread and the sea level rose and then got colder again and went warmer again. And there was this constant oscillation throughout time. And at the moment, we're just living in the most recent, what we call post-glacial or interglacial.
But what happened to the movements of Homo sapiens at during the periods of the glaciation? I mean, are they still moving into Europe and then over into Asia?
If we take before our species, modern humans, 100,000 years ago, early species seemed to expand their range during the warm, wet periods. And then when it got cold and dry, they tended to retreat back into low latitudes, especially back into Africa. Then they'd expand again and then retreat again. And as they retreated, the populations probably declined as well. And this probably had an impact on the evolution of language, because just as it was get going, those populations were knocked back into small populations.
Yeah.
You know, really low. Now, modern humans, after 100,000 years ago, we did things differently, because when we expanded out of Africa, say at about 70,000 years ago, and we came into Europe at 40,000 years ago, just as the last ice age was getting to a peak, now we're a bit clever, because for some reason that I attribute to language, they're able to make themselves much better shelters, make really good fur and skin clothing, build really substantial fires. So we stayed in those ice age areas. We stayed in those cold areas because we had a cultural adaptation to be able to do that. And I think that's a tribute of having sophisticated language, so we could communicate, live in more complex social groups. It gave us the ability to make inventions like bone needles and better hunting weapons. So we culturally adapted to those really ice age conditions. The Neanderthals didn't. They went extinct. And I think that's because, you know, they struggled through these really cold periods. And I think their language wasn't as sophisticated as us. And they just got knocked back again. And they never came back, because now they were competing with language using Homo sapiens that was just a much more effective type of human in those environments.
For me, reading the book, that was one of the major takeaways, was that the physical culture evolution that went on was made possible by the development of language. For instance, the move from hunter-gatherers to agriculture, language had to be part of that development, that evolution.
Well, I think it does. I think it does. Because it's quite interesting, because if you look back to those other warm periods in the past, you know, people didn't invent agriculture then. And you think, well, why didn't they? But when we get into about 10,000 years ago, at that time, or soon after that, over the next few thousand years, agriculture is independently invented in Asia. That's in modern day, the Fertile Crescent, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and so forth. But soon after that, in China, and then after that, in India, in New Guinea, in the Americas, all independently, all over the world. Now, these aren't people who are in contact with each other. So there's something newly creative in the modern human mind that just wasn't there before. And it's something that's universal to these populations. And I think that's got to be language. And I think language gives you this sort of capacity for more creative thought and for inventing more technical tools. And if you haven't got that, I think it's very difficult to get out of the traditional hunting-gathering way of life. Because, of course, once farming is there, you know, innovation continues. It's only a few thousand years after farming that we've got towns and trade and early civilizations.
It also seems like it becomes necessary to communicate. When you're farming and you're planning out what you're going to plant this year or next year, or there's going to be scarcities, it seems like language is crucial.
Yeah, and that language is crucial to that. But, you know, it's crucial in hunting and gathering as well.
Yep, you're right.
Whether you're Homo erectus or Neanderthals or Homo sapiens, verbal communication is important in those as well, and for passing cultural traditions. But you don't need a language which is as sophisticated as we use. And I think the critical difference between those early languages and those modern humans is like the use of metaphor. You know, metaphor is so important for us. And I think metaphor is a thing that really enables to do agriculture. Because when you start growing plants and planting seedlings, really you're thinking of them almost like your children, or somebody's got to be cared for. You're nurturing them. And I think that transferring that way of thought from your other social beings, whether it's children, the infirm or the elderly, onto plants and animals. And I think you're thinking of them in a metaphorical way as sort of types of humans. And I think that's that capacity for thought that language is giving you, actually, that early humans lacked. And that's why we can start doing this much more creative things using language. But language was important to earlier humans. It just lacked some of these key features that we use today.
You're listening to
that's my theory.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is archaeologist Stephen Mithen. He's professor of early prehistory at the University of Reading, and we're talking about his book, The Language Puzzle, piecing together the 6 million year story of how words evolved. Stephen, one of the things, you bring in so many threads to this, to putting the pieces to the puzzle together. One of them you talk about is the development of an extended childhood as one of the things that would inspire the creation of more complex languages. And that had to do with as hominids evolved, there was the globularization of the brain.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that when... Yeah, it doesn't trip and run trippingly off the tongue.
Yeah.
But then you because of that, you now are having children that have to be cared for, that have to be looked after. And that's one of the things that would precipitate the further development in language.
Yeah, that's right. You know, humans are different to the life history of a human is different to that of any other primate, like a gorilla or a chimpanzee, because we have this phase of childhood. With chimpanzees, you go right from an infant to an able juvenile. But we have a long period of childhood where children sort of fend for themselves in a way, but they still need a great deal of looking after. We also have a long period of extended postmenopausal lifespan as well, which is unique. Now, it's likely with early big-brained humans, that's Heidelbergensis, Neanderthals, Homo sapiens, this childhood began expanding. The reason for that is you can only give birth to a infant with a relatively small brain because just the physical thing of actually women giving birth through the pelvic girdle when they're bipedal, because that makes it relatively narrow. So as soon as you become bipedal and as soon as you've got a big brain, you sort of have this period of extended childhood during which it's an opportunity for the brain to keep developing at a very rapid fetal place for new networking the brain to develop. So that gives lots of capacity for new cultural abilities to develop. Now, after about 300,000 years ago, the shape of the brain in Homo sapiens changes. It changes from being relatively flat and elongated to become this beautiful spherical skull and brain that we have today. That would have probably either further extended childhood, just because, again, the infants are being born with a relatively small brain, need much longer period of looking after as they continue their fetal development rate out of the womb, and now subject to all sorts of cultural influences. But, you know, recent research is helping us identify some of the genetics, some of the genes that are associated with that globularization, or they develop this big spherical brain. And we know that some of them are involved in the development of neural networks in the brain. So I don't think it's only the case of the brain changing shape. I think it's becoming networked differently inside, with much more extended degree of connectivity, which, again, relates to this idea of metaphor, joining up different ideas, blending ideas, making novel connections, that I think is the hallmark of being modern humans. You know, we're just flitting all over the place in our ideas, because our brains are just connecting all sorts of things up together.
You talk about the likely evolution of words, lexical words, types of words, to go from like more concrete words to more abstract words, like the idea of things like freedom, justice, or democracy. Yeah. Talk to me. I mean, how long do you think that development would take to go from just like bird, you know, bison, into this more abstract words?
Well, again, I think this is one of the key transitions to develop modern language. You know, concrete words are the things that we can sense. You can see or touch hear them. So and they try to. And if I was a hunter-gatherer and I said, you know, this is blue or that's a banana, I could just point to it and you know what I mean. But if I'm talking to you about an abstract word, I'd say, you know, I believe in love or something like that. How do I explain that to you? It's a very difficult concept to have. And really, we need to use, again, analogies and metaphors to explain what I mean. And the same with words like freedom or democracy or, you know, all these abstract concepts that are so important to us today. But you can't see or hear or touch them. And often we understand different things. They're quite, you know, I think sometimes the meaning of these is quite ambiguous. So I think that's a key development of, again, of modern language happening around 100,000 years ago. And again, I'd attribute that to this capacity of metaphor, because if I can start saying that, you know, love is like the sun out on a lovely day and flowers and birds singing, and I'm just feeling wonderful, that's what love is. You get that sense of what I'm feeling. If I can't make those sort of analogies and metaphors, I don't think I can actually grasp that, those concepts, those abstract words at all. So abstract words and metaphors, I think they're very tied together. And this is a transition from a Neanderthal-like language or a Homo erectus-like language to the language of modern humans.
One of my favorite sentences you wrote in this book is that Homo sapiens laughed their way to modernity.
Yeah. Well,
and you can see, we were just talking about, as soon as you start making metaphors and talking abstractly, humor starts to creep in there.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Now, I just picture these early Homo sapiens, you know, 100,000 years ago, sitting around their fireplaces in the depths of the Iron Age, just laughing their hearts out, actually. As they're beginning to understand, oh, you know, there's puns coming up and there's verbal jokes coming up, and they're playing all these word games with this new capacity for language that they've got. And, you know, we love word games today. We love puns and jokes and so forth, and games we play with language, whether it's crosswords or Wordle or Scrabble and so forth. I think there is something really, we've evolved to really enjoy words and the fun with words and the beauty with words. I don't see why that's not present in the past as well. You know, we don't tend to think of our human ancestors as having much fun, but I'm sure they were having fun, just as much fun, if not more so than we do. But, you know, there is another side of that. Words are also really dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
That's right.
You know, your president can just say a few words and there we are in the next world war, can't we? So words are really dangerous and they're really scary. So there's two sides of a coin here. With the fun also comes the danger.
And lying. Telling untruths, that has to become a thing early on too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, we've got to think of these early humans as being a bit, you know, they're a bit competitive between each other, they're a bit manipulative, just like we are today. And some are going to be deceitful, some are going to be honest. And how do you tell when somebody's lying or not? And, you know, this is something that we've become attuned to more so in the last 5 years, perhaps, than we were ever before, because now this is impacting on world events rather than just personal lives.
Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, literally. You use a word, prosody.
Yeah.
Describe it as the music of language.
Yeah. That's all our use of changes of pitch and rhythm and, you know, when we're talking. And so much of the meaning comes from that as well.
For so many languages, I immediately think of Chinese, where you can just change the pitch or the length of holding a sound, and it changes everything.
Yeah, that really changes the meaning. But I can say something to you. You know, if I end my sentence in a in a rising tone, that makes it a question. If I end it in a lowering tone, that makes it a statement. So I can change the meaning of what I'm talking to you. But those tonal languages take it to an extreme. The same word, spoken in different pitch, can have a radically different meaning. I think that music and language had a common origin back about 2 million years ago. And, you know, that's why we've got still got lots of musicality in our language today.
Haven't people, there have been a few people that have suggested that music and song came first and then language?
Yeah, they have. And I think,
but there's no evidence for that.
No, there's even less evidence for that than there is for what I'm talking about in language. But I think it's quite a compelling idea, because if you look at, you know, when little babies are born, they're really receptive to music, much more so than language.
Yeah.
And they sort of come into the world with sort of a musical knowledge. They don't really come into the world with much linguistic knowledge, but they come into the world of musical knowledge. So I think musicality does have quite deep roots in us, in all of us.
We're completely out of time, and literally we could be talking about this book for hours. There's so many interesting parts of it. My guest tonight is archaeologist Stephen Myfen. He's a professor of early prehistory at the University of Reading, and we've been talking about his book, The Language Puzzle, piecing together the 6 million year story of how words evolved. Stephen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. It's been great. Thank you.
You listen to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.